Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Okay, let's dive in. Imagine two students, right? Sitting side by side, same classroom. Let's just say they won the genetic lottery for doing well in school and the other didn't.
Mm-hmm. And we know from decades of twin studies that genetics isn't trivial here. The heritability for how kids perform in school is pretty massive, around 50%.
50%. It's really the elephant in the room for educational policy, isn't it?
It absolutely is. The big question isn't if genetics matters, but, you know, can our schools, the environment we invest so much in, actually overcome those differences?
Exactly. And that pushes us towards a really critical policy question. Does putting kids in a better school, a high-quality environment, does that act like a leveler? Does it compensate for genetic disadvantages?
Or does it do the opposite? Does a great school just help those already genetically advantaged pull even further ahead, making the genetically rich even richer, so to speak?
Finding a solid causal answer to that, it's been incredibly difficult.
Oh, total scientific headache. Because genetic predispositions and the environment the kids grow up in, including their schools, are just so tangled up with family background, parental genetics, all that stuff.
Yeah, you can't exactly run an experiment where you randomly assign DNA or, you know, randomly assign kids to different quality schools, ethically or practically.
Right.
But this deep dive today, it actually delivers a causal answer. It uses this really impressive study design combining genetics and massive register data from Norway.
And what's really fascinating, I think, is that the answer isn't simple. It's not a yes or no across the board.
No, it shows this crucial kind of surprising difference between how the school environment impacts reading skills versus numeracy skills. And that's where it gets really interesting.
It definitely changes how we might need to think about educational equity.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of how they did it, let's give some credit where it's due. Special recognition time.
Absolutely. Today we celebrate the work of Rosa Cheeseman, Nikolai Borgen, Astrid M.J. Sansar, and Paul Huf.
And their institutions, too, like the University of Oslo and the University of Bristol,
They've
really pushed forward our understanding of this tricky relationship between school quality and genetic predispositions for education.
Yeah, their work tackles a really important shift in policy focus. You know, for years, the main conversation in education policy was about compensating for differences in socioeconomic status or maybe race or gender.
Right. Those are the traditional equity dimensions.
But now the frontier is really understanding these genetic differences, especially the ones we can start to measure, however imperfectly, with things like polygenic indices for educational attainment or PGIEA.
And the whole point of an equity policy really is finding things, interventions, environments that work better for those who start out with some kind of disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. You want the environment to actively counteract those initial differences, not just, you know, let them play out or even make them bigger.
We need to know where the levers are. Where can policy actually make a difference in closing those gaps?
But like we said, the science hit a wall. Previous studies looking at this gene-environment interaction, or GXE, in schools, they were, frankly, all over the place.
Yeah, inconsistent results. Sometimes suggesting schools amplify genetic differences, sometimes suggesting they compensate it.
And the main reason for that messiness was the inability to really nail down causality.
Okay, let's break down why that causality piece is so hard. There are basically two big confounding problems, right? Let's start with the genetics.
Right, so if you just take a standard PGIEA score for a child, that score is almost always correlated with their parents' own education, their income, their social class.
Because parents pass on both their genes and their environment.
Exactly. That's the problem of indirect parental genetic effects, sometimes called genetic nurture. You don't know if a child with a high PGIEA is doing well because of the genes they inherited or because their parents, who likely also have high PGIEA, created a really stimulating home environment, books everywhere, lots of vocabulary, that kind of thing.
So the child's genetic signal is contaminated, you could say, by the family privilege that often travels with those genes.
Precisely. And then you have the flip side, the E, the environment, the school quality.
It's also not random.
Definitely not. We all know that in reality, kids aren't randomly assigned to schools. More affluent families or parents of kids who are already doing well often manage to get their kids into schools perceived as better.
Right. That's the classic selection bias problem.
It's huge in education research. A school might look like it's getting amazing results, but is it the school itself, or did it just start with a bunch of kids who were already set up to succeed?
So to prove the school itself is having a causal effect, you need a way to somehow account for who walks in the door. You need to isolate the school's added value.
Okay, so those are the big challenges. How did this study manage to tackle both of them?
This is what makes the paper pretty remarkable, I think.
Yeah, the methodology is key. They use data from Norway, combining two powerful resources.
Mm-hmm. First, the Norwegian mother, father, and child cohort study. They call it MOBA. And second, Norway's amazing population-wide administrative registers.
So MOBA gave them the genetic data DNA from over 30,000 kids and their parents. That's crucial. And the registers gave them everything else.
Pretty much. Objective data on school performance, test scores, family background, socioeconomic status, loads of information.
Okay, let's take the confounding problems one by one. How did having the parents' DNA help them isolate the causal effect of the child's genes, the G?
This is where the within-family PGIEA comes in. It's a really elegant approach. Because they have genetic data on mom, dad, and the trio, they can statistically control for the PGIEA scores of both parents.
Yeah.
Right.
And when you do that, what's left over in the child's PGIEA score is essentially the part that was randomly determined by which specific set of parental genes the child happened to inherit during meiosis.
Ah, so it's like isolating the pure genetic lottery effect, the coin flip that happened at conception, separate from the broader family background.
Exactly. It's the random shuffling of genes within that specific family.
And they checked this worked. How do you know that remaining genetic bit is truly random and not still tied to, say, family income?
They showed it empirically. Once they applied the parental controls, this within-family component of the child's PGIEA was no longer correlated with the parent's education or income.
Wow.
It effectively strips out that dynastic effect, that inherited privilege, leaving just the child's direct genetic predisposition unconfounded by the family environment created by the parent's genes.
That's a huge step for using genetics in social science.
Oh.
Okay, that solves the G confounding. What about the E confounding the non-random school assignment? How did they get a causal measure of school quality?
They used established methods for calculating school value added, or VAID. It's important to understand what VAID is and isn't.
Right. It's not just the school's average test score.
No, definitely not. VAID tries to estimate the causal impact of the school environment itself, the teaching, the resources, the peer effects, all of it, by looking at how much students progress at that school compared to similar students who went elsewhere.
So you're comparing apples to apples. Taking two kids who looked identical on paper before they started at different secondary schools, same prior achievement, same family background, maybe even the same within family PGIEA, and seeing how much they improve.
That's the idea. The rich Norwegian register data let them control for a whole host of prior characteristics, previous test scores going way back, detailed family SES, parental education, the works.
So by comparing the progress of initially similar students in different schools, they can attribute the difference in progress to the quality of the schools themselves.
Precisely. It statistically approximates a situation where students were randomly assigned, allowing for a causal interpretation of the school quality effect, the VAID measure.
Okay, so they managed to get arguably causal measures for both G, within family PGIEA, and E, school VAID. That's the setup. Let's get to the results. They looked at standardized reading and numeracy scores in grade 9. What happened with reading?
For reading, they found something really clear and quite exciting from an equity perspective. A statistically significant negative gene environment interaction.
Negative interaction. Okay, what does that mean in plain English?
It means the environment and genes are acting as substitutes.
Substitutes, meaning a better environment can stand in for or compensate for a lower genetic predisposition.
Exactly. A high-quality school environment helped to make up for a lower starting point based on the within-family PGIEA for reading.
That sounds really promising. What was the size of the effect? How much compensation did they find?
Quantitatively, a one standard deviation increase in score quality, the VAID score, decreased the impact of a one standard deviation increase in the within family, PGIEA, on reading scores by about 6%.
6% reduction in the genetic effect, just from being in a better school for that year. That feels substantial.
It is. And crucially, they looked at how this compensation happened. It wasn't just that everyone did a bit better in the good schools.
Right.
The compensation specifically came from gains made by students at the lower end of the PGIEA distribution. The good schools were particularly effective at lifting the reading scores of those kids who had a lower genetic predisposition.
So the genetic gap in reading was smaller or flatter in the higher quality schools compared to the lower quality schools.
Exactly. Now, here's the twist that makes this study even more compelling.
Okay.
They ran the exact same analysis, same causal methods, but looking at grade 9 numeracy test scores instead of reading, a complete null finding. Nothing.
Zero interaction. No compensation, no amplification for numeracy.
Zilch. The point estimate for the interaction term was literally 0.000. And the estimate was precise enough that they could confidently rule out any GXE interaction, positive or negative, even half the size of what they saw for reading.
Wow. So high quality schools compensate for genetic differences in reading, but not in numeracy. At least not in grade 9.
Correct. That stark contrast is really the puzzle at the heart of the paper.
Okay, let's unpack that in the discussion. The reading finding seems like pretty straightforward good news for policy, right?
It does. It suggests that investing in improving school quality, boosting that VAID, is a valid way to promote equity in reading skills. It can genuinely narrow those gaps that arise partly from genetic differences. It validates the idea that schools can be compensatory environments.
But there's a darker side to that finding too, isn't there? The double disadvantage idea.
Yeah, that's the flip side for reading. If you're a student with a lower PGIEA for reading, you're already facing a challenge. But if you also end up in a lower quality school, that environment actually makes your disadvantage worse.
The gap widens even further in those poorer school environments.
Exactly. Those schools seem to magnify the initial genetic differences in reading.
Okay, so why this difference? Why compensation in reading but not numeracy? Why can good schools level the playing field for one skill but not the other by this age?
The researchers offer a pretty convincing explanation linked to something called skill persistence. They use the Greek letter torafo, O-B-R, to measure it.
Skill persistence. Does that mean how much your skill level today depends on your skill level yesterday?
Basically, yes. How much does past achievement predict current performance in that specific subject? If a skill is highly persistent, it means your current level is strongly determined by where you were before. New inputs, like being in a better school for a year, have less power to dramatically change your trajectory quickly.
Ah, okay. It's like if the skill's already set, like hardened concrete, it's hard for a new environment to reshape it quickly. Mm-hmm. But if it's still like wet cement.
That's a great analogy. And that's what they found. For numeracy skills in grade 8, the persistence was quite high. Rho was 0.702.
So by age 14 or so, math skills are relatively sticky, cumulative, and harder to shift rapidly.
Seems like it. But for reading skills at the same age, the persistence was much lower. Rho was only 0.462. Reading was more like the wet cement.
More malleable.
Right. And that difference, they argue, is key. Because numeracy was already so persistent by grade 8, even a really high-quality school just didn't have much scope over 1 year to dramatically close the gap between the low PGIEA and high PGIEA students. Their math performance was already largely set by their prior trajectory.
But for reading, which was less persistent, more adaptable.
The high-quality school environment could make a bigger difference, faster. It had more room to boost the skills of those starting lower down, hence the compensation effect.
That makes a lot of sense, and it has pretty big implications for when we might need to intervene. Especially for math. We should come back to that.
Definitely.
First, let's revisit the size of that reading effect. The 6% reduction in genetic impact was just over 1 year, grade 8.
Yes. And the researchers did a simple extrapolation, assuming that effect is roughly constant each year over the 3 years of lower secondary school in Norway.
The total reduction in the impact of genetics on reading skills could add up.
Potentially to around 18%. 18% less influence from the genetic lottery on reading outcomes. Purely due to the quality of the school environment. That's a non-trivial effect for policy.
For sure. So what might these high-quality schools actually be doing to achieve this compensation in reading? What are the possible mechanisms?
Well, the study can't pinpoint the exact mechanisms, but they suggest a couple of possibilities. One is just direct mechanisms, maybe related to diminishing returns.
Meaning kids with lower reading skills just have more room to improve, so they benefit more from good instruction.
Could be part of it. Or maybe the schools with high VAD scores are better at targeting resources or specific teaching strategies towards students who are struggling more with reading. More small group work, more individualized attention for them.
Okay, that makes sense. What else?
The other category is indirect mechanisms, which involve how families might react.
How so?
Well, imagine you're a parent of a child with a high PGI-EA for reading. If you know they're in a fantastic school, maybe you subconsciously pull back a bit on your own efforts at home, reading together, buying extra books, that kind of thing.
Ah, so the parents' adjustment could contribute to flattening the overall gradient in the good schools.
It's plausible. The negative GXE interaction they observe could be a mix of what the school does directly and how families respond indirectly.
But teasing that apart would need different data, right?
Exactly. That's a clear next step. Future research needs to combine these strong causal methods, the within-family PGIEA, the VAD scores, with really detailed data on what actually happens inside classrooms, what specific school practices distinguish the high VAD schools, and measure parental inputs more directly, too.
Got it. And we should be careful about generalizing these findings too widely, I suppose.
Definitely. This is Norway. It's lower secondary school, and the PGIEA only captures some of the genetic influence. It's context dependent.
Yeah, if you had a school system in another country that was really focused on, say, gifted and talented programs and pushing the top students even higher,
you might see a very different pattern, maybe even amplification instead of compensation. So context matters a lot.
Okay, so wrapping up the core findings. This research gives us some pretty clear, causally identified evidence that, at least for reading skills in this context, high-quality schools really do act as compensatory environments.
Mm-hmm. They actively mitigate the impact of that genetic lottery, especially helping kids with lower genetic predispositions catch up.
The big take-home message seems to be, yes, there's a genetic lottery influencing educational outcomes, but school quality isn't just passively letting it play out. Good schools can be powerful forces for narrowing those genetically linked gaps, particularly in reading during adolescence.
It's one of the strongest demonstrations we have that environment can genuinely substitute for genetic differences in a setting that matters hugely for policy.
So let's end with that provocative thought you hinted at earlier. Given this striking difference in skill persistence reading being more like wet cement in adolescence, while numeracy is more like hardened concrete, what does this imply for where we should focus our efforts?
Right. If trying to close genetically based gaps in math is already tough by grade 8 because the skill is so persistent,
does that mean interventions targeting numeracy inequality need to happen much, much earlier? Like kindergarten, early elementary school, when maybe those math foundations are still more malleable, still wet cement?
It certainly raises that question very sharply. Where can our interventions have the biggest impact in leveling that particular playing field?
Food for thought.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.